It is September the 13th, and we are in Parshas Mikates, and we are
page
226, and we're going to try to get to a good stopping point this week, because we're going to have such a long break after this. Okay, so we were up to Yosef's unsolicited advice to Paro. After he's interpreted the dreams, which was fine, now he offers Paro advice. And we already pointed out that we started reading it. We'll read it again, part of the advice, and we'll add some more comments. So starting with Lamed Gimel 33, now, Paro should seek out a person who is a man who is Navon v'chacham. Last week we talked about the difference between Navon and Chacham. Navon is Bina, Chacham is Chachma, different types of wisdom. We talked about it last week. And should appoint him over the land of Egypt. Yaseh Paro, Paro should, the English says here, proceed. Paro should do. V'yafkeid pikidim al ha'aretz, and he should appoint overseers on the land, v'chimesh ha'aretz Mitzrayim, and he should prepare the land of Egypt, v'shem ha'shnei ha'sava, during the 7 years of famine. Thank you. 7 years of abundance. V'yikbitzu eskol ochel ha'shanim ha'tovos ha'ba'os ha'elem, they should gather all the food of the good years that are coming, these good years that are coming, the yitzpiru var, and they should gather, literally means gather a pile. What do they say here? They should gather
a mass grain.
Okay. Tachas yad paro, under the hand of paro, which means under the protection of paro. Ochel ve'arim, food in its cities, vishamaru, and it will be protected. V'hayah ochel lefikadon la'aretz, and the food will be as a reserve for the land. L'sheva shnei hara'av, for the 7 years of famine, asher tiyena b'eretz Mitzrayim, that will be in the land of Egypt. V'lo sikares ha'aretz bara'av, and the land will not be destroyed in the famine. One point before we turn the page is in verse 35, Lamed Hey, where it says in the end, ochel be'arim v'shamaru, the food in its cities, and it will be protected. Rashi says that Yosef told him that if you take the dirt in which the crops grew, and you mix it with the crops in the silos, that will help preserve the crops. The point being, not just that dirt helps preserve the crops, but specifically the dirt that it grew in, as opposed to other dirt. So take the dirt of the city that grew the crops, take the dirt of that particular city, and mix it with the crops in that particular city's silo.
Okay. Do we know
what was in the dirt? I assume it's just because it's in the ground, so it has better protective powers. Remember, they didn't have any. There's no refrigeration, and they didn't have any way of vacuum packing it either. I mean, this is just sealed, but not vacuum packed in any way. So you know, I guess that was the method of making it.
Maybe the moisture in the soil would keep. Drying out?
Maybe. You would imagine moisture would be bad for it.
Yeah,
you know.
But
I'm not
sure. It has to be some mineral or something that preserves it. Well, they were all into agriculture.
Well, we will see. We will see not tonight. We will see next time. Remember, we'll see next time that there was a lot of hoarding going on during these 7 years. Not just Yosef's stash, which was, of course, a massive amount of food. But the Egyptians as well tried to hoard their food, and we will see that their plans failed. Only Yosef's survived, as we'll see. That was miraculous, as we'll see later. Next page. Vayitav hadavar b'nei Pharaoh u'b'nei chol avadav. The thing was good in the eyes of Paro, and in the eyes of all of his servants. Now, follow carefully what happens here. Here we're going to have, as we know, the sudden rise to power of Yosef, where he goes from being a slave to being the viceroy of Egypt. And it's going to happen in just a few verses. And it literally happened in seconds. It's one audience with Paro, and he goes from being a slave and a prisoner, etc., to being the viceroy of Egypt. Now, watch the progression over here. It shouldn't, you know, we read it every year, and we know that it happens, so we kind of get jaded. We don't really follow it carefully anymore. But if you look at it carefully, it really ought to raise a lot of questions in our mind. It doesn't seem that someone, there's a person here who does not seem to be acting rationally. Follow carefully and see if you can point out the person who is not acting rationally. So the thing was good in the eyes of Paro and the eyes of all of his servants. So they were impressed. Vayomer Paro el avadav, and Paro said to his servants, Hanimtza chazeh, can we find like this, Ish asher ruach elokim bo, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? Can we find another person like him? Vayomer Paro el Yosef. So that's what he said to his servants. So first he addressed his servants and he said, can we find anybody else like this person? Mm-hmm. Then he turns to Yosef. Vayomer Paro el Yosef. Paro says to Yosef, Acharei hodia elokim oscha es kol zos. Once God has revealed all this to you, made you know all these things, ein navon v'chacham kamocha. There's no one as much as wise as you. Those two attributes which you said we need to find, a man who is navon v'chacham, which is two different types of wisdom, there's no one else but you, no one as great as you in these attributes. Ata tiyel beisi, you will be in charge of my house. V'apicha yishak kolami, and on your mouth, all of my nation will be sustained. Rak hakisei agdal mimecha, only the throne will I be greater than you. Meaning, you'll be the viceroy, you'll be second in command. Only my throne will supersede you. Other than that, you're in charge. That was the first statement he made to Yosef. Now we get a second statement. Vayomer Paro el Yosef. And Paro said to Yosef. Now Paro had been talking to Yosef. So if the Torah repeats Vayomer Paro el Yosef, Paro said to Yosef, instead of just including it in the previous two verses, then evidently this is a new point that Paro is making. Re'eina sati oscha al kol eretz Mitzrayim. See, I have put you over all the land of Egypt. Vayasa Paro es tabato me'al yado. Paro took his ring from upon his finger. This is Paro's special signet ring that he wore. Vayiteno sa al yad Yosef, and he put it on the hand of Yosef. Vayavesh oso bigdei sheish, and he dressed him in clothing of linen, linen clothing. Vayasem revid hazahav al tzavaro, and he put the golden necklace on his neck. A revid is a necklace. He put the golden necklace on his neck. Vayarkev oso, and he rode him bimirkeves hamishnah shelo, in his second chariot that he had, the chariot for the, it was Air Force 2. Right? This was the second chariot. Chariot 2 of Egypt. Obviously the number 1 being reserved for Paro. Vayikru'u lefanav Avreich, and they called in front of him Avreich. That was the title. That was the announcement that they called. Every Yosef came by, they would yell Avreich. That's what they called, and we'll discuss what that word means in a moment. Vinason oso al kol eretz Mitzrayim, and he placed him, or he was placed, over all the land of Egypt. Vayomer Paro el Yosef, and Paro said to Yosef. Now a third statement that Paro makes to Yosef. Ani Yosef, excuse me, Ani Paro, I am Paro. Uvil adecha, and without you, which means without your consent, lo yorim ish es yado ve'es raglo v'chol eretz Mitzrayim. No man will lift his hand nor his foot in all the land of Egypt. What that means is, as the Targum explains over here, Targum Yonasan explains, no one will be allowed to bear arms. Loyorim, this is the which amendment is that? The Second Amendment, right? This is where you have Yosef, right? Paro says, without your permission, no one in Egypt will be allowed to bear arms. That's what it means to raise his hand. Nor will anyone be able to ride on a horse. That's what it means with his foot. No one can do these things without your permission in all the land of Egypt. That's right. He gave him sweeping powers. Vayikra Pharaoh. If Yosef wanted to be a tyrant, a dictatorial tyrant, he could have been so. He had sweeping power. All of a sudden, he was given sweeping powers over all of Egypt. Vayikra Pharaoh shem Yosef tzofnas paneach. And Paro called the name of Yosef Tzofnas Paneach, the one who sees or interprets that which is hidden. Vayiten lo es Asnas, and he gave him Asnas, Bas Potiphera, the daughter of Potiphera, Kohen Ha'on, who was the Kohen of On, On as a place, Leisha as a wife. So he gave him Asnas, the daughter of Potiphera, who was the Kohen of On as a wife. Vayetze Yosef al Eretz Mitzrayim, and Yosef went out on the land of Egypt, which means Yosef now has been set up and he is now ready to take over as the viceroy of Egypt. V'Yosef ben Shloshim Shana, Yosef was 30 years old. Be'amdo lifnei Pharaoh melech Mitzrayim, when he stood before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Vayetze Yosef min lifnei Pharaoh, and Yosef went out from before Pharaoh. Vayavor b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, and he went out and he passed through the entire land of Egypt. And that's what we're going to pause for now. And of course, the next step is going to be his implementing the plan of storing up the crops. But that's for later. So here we have Yosef's, as I keep saying, the meteoric rise to power of Yosef, where he goes from being a prisoner, a slave, a foreigner, to being viceroy. We use that word viceroy almost casually, almost callously. But you see what it means. He goes to being the viceroy, but viceroy means sweeping powers, where he's given power over everything, where his word is law, where he controls who bears arms, who rides horses. He has Pharaoh's signet ring. Could Yosef order somebody's death? Absolutely. Could Yosef take somebody's money or property? Absolutely. Could Yosef enforce slave labor? Absolutely. Yosef had sweeping powers. Now, we don't know that he did any of these things, but he had sweeping powers. We are not going to see him exercise the sweeping powers in the next several chapters. We won't see him exercise those sweeping powers except in regard to how he treats his brothers, as you know. When his brothers come down to Egypt, which will be the whole new next story we're going to deal with, and that'll take us a number of weeks throughout the November and October, November, part of December, we'll probably be spending a lot of time on Yosef and the brothers. We won't see him use this power except regarding his brothers. After the whole story with the brothers ends, the Torah will have a flashback and will tell us what happened in Egypt during the 2 years prior, where the famine began, prior to the brothers coming down to Egypt. How did Yosef deal with the people of Egypt? And then we will see a little bit of how Yosef exercised his power. Then we will see. He did not act as a tyrant, but he did take control, and he kept control of the land of Egypt, as we will see. But that's a long way off. Chronologically, it's the next thing that happens after the 7 years of plenty, but in the Torah, it's not dealt with until after the story of the brothers, because obviously the story of the brothers is really what we want to get to. That's the main event. So, who's not acting rationally over here? Pharaoh. What is wrong with Pharaoh? What's up with Pharaoh? Has he lost his mind?
He's seen the light.
He's seen the light. This is an incredible, incredible thing that's going on here with Pharaoh. I understand, we pointed out a couple of weeks ago, that Pharaoh is more taken with Yosef than anyone else, because Pharaoh knows better than anyone Yosef's genius. Because, remember, we pointed out a couple of weeks ago that what Yosef did is when the butler told Pharaoh Yosef's interpretations of the butler and the baker's dreams, no one knew better than Pharaoh how lucky Yosef was to get it right. Because when Yosef interpreted the butler and baker's dreams, he was interpreting what Pharaoh would do. And Pharaoh himself knew that up until the very moment when he made the decree to execute the baker and bring the butler back to his position, Pharaoh knew that up until that very moment, he really had decided the opposite. That his real intention had been to execute the butler and bring the baker back to his position. And only at the last moment, for inexplicable reasons as far as Pharaoh was concerned, he on a whim decided, you know what, I'll switch it. And here, this kid in jail figured it out. So Pharaoh knows better than anyone how incredible Yosef's powers of perception are. So we understand that Pharaoh has a better feel for Yosef's greatness than anyone else. But nevertheless, that doesn't justify this. That doesn't justify taking someone... Okay, so he's proven himself of being a very wise person. He can interpret dreams. Maybe he's even proven himself to be a good advisor to the king, because he not only interpreted the dreams, as we pointed out the past 2 weeks, but he told Pharaoh what to do with the interpretation, which would, number one, save Egypt, Number two, save Paro, because you would imagine a king under whom his nation starves to death is not going to be king for very long. They're gonna overthrow him. If a king can't last, if his nation is starving, they're gonna throw him out because he's a terrible leader. So he saves the people of Mitzrayim, he saves Paro, and he even gives Paro a means of becoming the most powerful king in all the land. Because all countries now become subservient to Paro, both economically and militarily, as we will see. So we understand that he's done incredible service for Paro. He's proven himself to be a good dream interpreter and even a good advisor to the king. That's fine. I can understand Paro even saying, you know what, Yosef, you figured it out, so you be that person who's going to run the plan. Good. But give him sweeping powers? Make him the most powerful person in the land, essentially rubber stamping anything Yosef does? It's basically saying, Paro's essentially telling Yosef, I'm going to sit in my throne, you go out and take care of the country. That's what he did. Gave him the ring, huh?
Lazy.
But, okay, you can call it lazy, but he gave him the ring, and gave him the chariot, and gave him the title, and gave him the power. Said, here, go ahead, the country's yours. You can't usurp me, I'm on the throne. But go ahead, the power's yours, I'm going to go watch TV. And that's what he did. That's what Paro did. What happened to Paro's mind? Where is he going with this? You have a question, or you want to answer this question?
Oh, I got lost in what you were saying.
I'm sorry.
I'll do it in a minute.
Okay.
What's the reference? Maybe it's the Hebrew to the English, but he was referring to God as Hashem as God.
Okay, that's a good point. We're going to get to that. That's excellent. Burton is making a good point that Paro says that. Have we found a man like this? Asher Ruach Elokim Bo. Elokim. Doesn't say Hashem's name, but it does say Elokim. That the God, the Spirit of God is in him. Very good. Okay, we're going to get to that. That's an excellent observation.
I think he's scared. Paro is very scared.
You think he's scared?
Very scared.
What's he scared of?
The 7 years of...
Okay, so you're suggesting Paro... Paro is worried. He doesn't know.
He doesn't know how he could do it.
Okay. So he hopes that Yosef will now not only interpret, but now he'll actually implement everything for him.
He has a special power.
Okay.
But if Yosef doesn't succeed, he can blame Yosef.
Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. So now he's put someone there who can take the blame. He now has a fall guy. Good.
Isn't it said that leaders lose their bechira once they become?
Okay. We know that the pasuk in Mishle says, "Lev melachim b'yad Hashem," that the heart of kings is in the hand of God. Now, that does not mean that a leader is absolved from his evil choices. If you say that, then you have to pardon Hitler, because he was the leader, right? So it doesn't mean that a leader is absolved from his evil choices, nor does that mean he isn't rewarded for his good choices. A leader still has free will. But there are certain aspects of decision-making which affect the national and international scene that it is no longer the leader's power to make. Certain things, because since Hashem, as we know, has a plan which he orchestrates, both a time local plan, he wants things to happen now, and also overall, where the world is headed, he has a plan. Those plans involve international decision making, and Hashem manipulates the leaders of countries, and the greater the country, the greater the manipulation, in order to make those plans come to fruition. So President Obama is making choices. He is making choices, and he is held accountable and is rewarded if he's held accountable if he makes poor choices, and he's rewarded if he makes good choices. But nevertheless, there are certain things that are not within his purview that he's going to do and say whether he likes it or not. Same thing with the previous President Bush. Same thing. Some of the things that he did, I can't tell you which decisions they were. I'm not a prophet. I can't tell you that. But there were certain things that he did which he had no choice, both for good and for bad. It's not just in America. That's true for leaders throughout the world. There are certain things that are done where they do not exercise their own choice for.
Is this to teach us what happened?
Well, what Mrs. Donowitz is saying is that perhaps over here, it's not Paro making his own decision.
Right.
This part of it is really Hashem simply using Paro to place Yosef where he wants Yosef to be. I just want to just make a point about that issue about Lev Malach and Biyad Hashem. You understand that's why the whole democratic process, which we ascribe to and we believe in this country, is somewhat misleading. In the end, there are certain decisions, not all, but there are certain decisions that are going to be made irrespective of who's in the White House. It doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican. It doesn't matter if they're radical or if they're whatever the other word is. If they're
conservative.
No, radical or
rational.
No. Radical or not so radical. Anyway, it doesn't make a difference. There are certain things that are going to happen no matter who's there, because Hashem is still running the show, and therefore there are certain decisions that are going to happen. Now, that doesn't mean that every decision is Hashem is manipulating, but there are certain things that are going to happen irrespective of who's in the White House, irrespective of who's in Congress, irrespective of who's on the Supreme Court. It's going to happen anyway. So that's something which we have to understand, that there are certain things that are not in the voters' control. They're going to happen anyway.
You can see that with the Israeli government.
And the Israeli government, for sure, it's true.
Sure.
There it's probably more true than anywhere else. But that's true. That's true. It's true in America, for sure, since America is the most powerful country. And it's true in any country that is affecting the world, Russia as well, any of these countries. Now, as I said, it doesn't mean every decision, and we're not necessarily able to figure out which of those decisions are being made from Hashem and which of them are being made by the leader himself. But there is that concept, and we should be aware of it, that it is a truth. Yes?
It's very clear, though. He says, I am Pharaoh. So he may be setting Joseph up, you know, but he's also, I think, making it clear who's really
yes.
on top.
Yes. Okay.
And I knew God has a plan. I keep telling myself that, and thank you.
Okay. Okay, we know he has a plan. It's not always a pleasant thing for us, but we know he has a plan. It is actually astonishing, Paro's first words here on his first words to his servants.
Could we find another?
In Pasuk Lamechesim 38. Where he says, can we find someone like this, a man who the Spirit of God is in him? Where did Paro get those words from? Where did he come to say the word God? Who mentioned the word God that Paro should then say anything about him?
Yosef.
Yosef, excellent. Yosef mentions God. Where does he mention God? He mentions it actually several times. First, he mentions Hashem's name when Paro asks him to interpret the dreams. Back on page 224, in Pasuk Tes Zion 16, when Paro says, I heard you can interpret dreams, Paro didn't say a word about God. Paro said, I heard you, Yosef, can interpret dreams. And Yosef immediately said, Vayan Yosef as Paro Lamar, Biladai, it's not me. Elokim Yanesh Shalom Paro, God will answer the peace of Paro. So it's God. Yosef immediately removes the prestige from himself. It's not about me. It's about God. And we pointed this out at the time. So right away, Yosef injects God into the whole discussion. Paro goes on to tell Yosef the dreams. And when Yosef interprets the dreams on the next page, he repeatedly mentions God's name. First of all, in 25, Nechav Hei, he says, that which God is doing, He has told Paro. That's number one. Number two, verse 28, Chavches. Paro. That's what I was saying to Paro. Asher Elokim Oseh Aras Paro. That which God is doing, He has shown Paro. That's two. Again, later on, in Pasuk Lamed Beis 32. And the fact that it was repeated to Paro, that this dream was told to Paro twice, because the thing is sure in from God. And God is being quick to do it. This is going to happen right away. So he mentions God now four times. He's mentioned God in his interpretation. So Yosef has talked about God four times in the interpretation. That was, again, as we've shown every time with Yosef's interpretation, was somewhat presumptuous of Yosef. He's talking to the king. The king could say to Yosef, I didn't ask you for a sermon. I asked you for an interpretation. But don't preach to me about God. Tell me what the dream means. But Yosef is not willing to do that. Yosef talks about God. Now we know this is true about Yosef anyway, because we know, and we pointed it out at the time, but let's just revisit it, that when Yosef became a prisoner, when Yosef became a slave, back on page 214, in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, at the top of the page, after Potiphar bought him and Yosef became a slave, it says, Vayar Adonav ki Hashem ito. His master saw that God was with him, and that everything he did, God was making him succeed. But what does Potiphar know about God? What does he know about Hashem? So Rashi says, Shem Shamayim Shagor Befiv. The name of heaven was regular on the mouth of Yosef. Everything Yosef said, constantly he spoke about God. Yosef, a sentence didn't come out of his mouth. He didn't have a conversation with Yosef where he wasn't mentioning Hashem. Thank God, please God, with the help of God. It was always God, 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 God. Everything with Yosef was about Hashem. Yosef lived his life that way, and he spoke that way. Yosef was a walking sermon. It was always about Hashem. And so you couldn't miss it. That was Yosef's way of speaking. And here we have a good illustration when he speaks to Paro. When he speaks to Paro about the dreams, it's always about Hashem. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's not about Egypt. It's about Hashem. Hashem, Hashem, Hashem. The astonishing thing is that Yosef succeeds in getting Paro to parrot back about God. That here he takes Paro, who is a pagan, who believes in a pagan beliefs, and gets Paro to acknowledge that there is Elohim, that there is God. We know that later on in Parshas Shemos, when Moshe first comes before Paro, and likely it's a different Paro. We don't know if it's the same Paro who just lived many, many years, or if it's a different Paro. We know the term Paro is a title, so it doesn't have to be the same person. But when Moshe comes before Paro, when the slavery is going on with the Jews, and he says that God has said that you should let his people go, so Paro's first response to Moshe is, Mi Hashem Asher Ishma B'Kolo. Who is this God? Who is this Hashem that I should listen to his voice? Lo Yadati Es Hashem. I never heard about this God. V'gam Es Yisrael Lo Ashalech. And also, I'm not going to send the Jews out. He says, Hashem, sorry, don't know that one. Right? Forget that one. I never heard of that one.
Right.
He throws that God. The whole process of the 10 plagues. The whole process of the 10 plagues is to get Paro, one of the points is to get Paro to acknowledge, as he says later on, after the plague of the Barad, of the hail, he says, Hashem HaTzadik, God is righteous. Vani v'ami harishayim, and I am a nation, we're the evil ones. He acknowledges that there's a God. Part of the process to get Paro to recognize, no, there is a God. It takes plague after plague after plague after plague to finally get him to admit it. Here, Yosef gets this pagan king to acknowledge God in one conversation. It's an amazing thing. And he acknowledges it, Paro acknowledges it more than once. He says, in Pasuk, back on page 228, he says, to his servants, he says, can we find someone like this, a man who the Spirit of God is in him? That's Pasuk Lamed Ches 38. And then later on, he says to Yosef, in Pasuk Lamed 39, Acharei Hodia Elokim Oscha Eskozos. Once God has told you all of this, then you must be the most wise person around.
Okay, so Pharaoh has his own gods.
He's
acknowledging that all of this is that Joseph is getting all this information from Joseph's God.
Correct.
So he's acknowledging that for some reason Joseph's God is pretty powerful.
Right.
But he is not, Pharaoh is not in effect actually accepting.
Correct. He's not repudiating
God.
That's right.
And repudiating all his
correct.
God.
That is correct.
Okay,
that
so
is
he's
correct.
Still pagan.
Right. He's still worshiping idolatry. He's not doesn't become a monotheistic belief system. That doesn't enter his right. But he acknowledges that there is this super God out there. The Rambam Maimonides writes that in the days of the Tanakh, of the Bible, in those days, the idolaters, many of them accepted that there was a super God, a power that superseded their own idolatries. But they felt that if they could have an in with their particular type of worship, the sun, the moon, the fish, the sea, whatever it is, if they could have an in with that particular God, then they could get favors and be helped by that particular God, and that super God, well, he's off playing golf. He's busy with other things. He's not going to get involved. So many of them believed that there was some super deity out there, but not one that mattered, not one that paid attention, not one that cared, not one that was involved. But the God of fish, that was the Philistine God. The God of the sun, that was another God. The God of, that was the God of rain, the God of different gods. And the gods of war with each other, etc. They even, many of them understood that the Jews worshipped the super God, the one that, the overarching God. But they it was rare that they would acknowledge that the Jews had the power to, that their God would then actually get involved to take care of the lower gods. Of course, we believe, and what the true belief is, that there is no other God. When we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, Hashem is one, it doesn't just mean that God is the strongest of all gods. It means that God is the only God. There is no minor God. Because a God means a power that can make decisions. A power that can help me or hurt me, depending if I'm nice to it or not. We don't believe in that. We believe that nothing has free will other than people and God. A person can hurt me or help me depending if I'm nice to that person or not. If I punch you in the nose, you're not going to be nice to me. And if I'm nice to you, you'll be nice to me. That's because all of you have free will. So we can do that with each other. People have free will. Hashem has free will. Therefore, if we do what we're supposed to do, he says he's going to help us. If we don't do what we're supposed to do, he says he's not going to help us. That's because Hashem has free will. Nothing else is free will. The sun doesn't have free will. The moon doesn't have free will. The fish doesn't have free will. The rain doesn't have free will. The oceans don't have free will. None of those things have free will. So all the pagans were wrong, even if they did acknowledge a super God, they were still wrong because they said, well, the sun has its own power and the moon has its own power, etc., etc., etc. Yeah?
Did they believe that by worshipping these different gods that it would influence the super god?
I don't know. It could be they did. I don't know. Mm. I don't know. I don't know how far it went. The Rambam devotes a few paragraphs to this particular idea, but I don't remember if he gets into that detail, that amount of detail.
When it's just with Yosef, it's Hashem. And he starts talking to Apollo.
Right. That's the difference, really, because even those who acknowledged that there was a superpower. See, the word Elohim just means power. That's what it means. What we say it, we don't want to say it with a hey, because we say it's one of God's names, but it's not the name of God. It is a name that means power. So when the pagans used the term, they just used it as superpower. But when Yosef uses it, he uses the Hashem's actual name. And that's why he uses a different word. That's correct.
He says Yosef says Elohim.
Well, he says Elohim a few times, But sometimes he says Hashem. Depends. Yosef, it depends on the time. Yosef will use one or the other.
I was just thinking that it's not just a sudden acceptance, maybe by a thought, that he's accepting Hashem, but his frame of mind was such that when Yosef helped him, he was more receptive. He was desperate almost to get help, whereas when Moshe approached he was not a desperate situation.
Oh, there's no question about it. That's correct. That's correct. You're saying...
So it's his frame of mind.
Yeah, there's no question.
That makes him more amenable to acknowledging something.
Right. You're pointing out that over here, for this paro to come to a recognition was easier than for the paro later on. Because the paro later on is sitting on top of the world. He's in control. Why should he listen? Over here, this paro is coming into it afraid, nervous, out of sorts, you know, not knowing what the future will bring. So there is he's more readily able to accept what Yosef is saying. That is correct.
The big difference between this parable, and maybe it's the same parable, but the big difference is that Yosef turned parable into a really super...
Right, right, right. The power, right. The power corrupt. The power corrupts. Exactly. The power corrupts. Whether it's the same power or a different power, once you're sitting on top of the world, you have all the power. You're much less apt to accept God. By the way, whoever mentioned before that Paro himself was a deity, it's not clear if that was true at this point in time. Later on, he certainly was. In the time of Moshe, there, Paro fancied himself to be a god, and they all thought so. At this time, it's not so clear that was true.
Interesting.
Yeah?
What does the word Paro mean? Do we know?
I'm not sure. The Mefarshim do discuss it. I mean, you know, I'm sure the secular etymologists discuss it as well, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It's an Egyptian word that means king or power or something like that. It's a title. Yeah, it's a title. Now, let's make some specific points over here in this discussion. So, Paro gives him all this power. So what we're saying is that Paro is giving Yosef all this power is likely has to do with Lev Malachim Biyad Hashem, that Hashem is the one who controls decision-making, major decisions of the kings, and here could very well be that he manipulated Paro to get Yosef to be where he had to be. That's number one. And number two, it could also be that Paro recognizes that Yosef has an in with the superpower, with the super god. And Paro sees it's in Paro's best interest to promote Yosef. Because if Yosef has an in with the super god, you want him on your side. You don't want him working against you. So that could also be what's going on over here. Be that as it may, he pushes Yosef all the way to the top and beyond. He pushes him, he gives him, he doesn't just make him the viceroy, he gives him the viceroy plus major power that really gives him the ability to do whatever he wants. He gives him the signet ring. Does this phrase ring a bell? Vayasar Paro es tabato me'al yado. He took his ring from on his finger, from on his hand, vayitain osal yad Yosef, and put it on the hand of Yosef. Exactly. Well, Haman first, and then Mordechai. Achashverosh took his ring and put it on Haman, and then later on to Mordechai. There are many, many parallels between Yosef and Paro, etc., and the story of Purim. Many, many parallels. That you'll see many verses that seem to parallel the two. I had a friend when we were both in yeshiva who wrote an essay on this subject. It was an excellent essay. I want to go consult my notes before I share it with you to see how he did it. We haven't seen enough yet to fully develop this thought. But hopefully, as we go through it and we see more parallels, we'll come back to this. I hope. We'll remember to come back to this.
From Rachel?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is true. Yosef, and that's true. Yosef is from Rachel, and so is Binyamin, which is Mordechai and Esther. That is true. Yeah, that is true. But, well, I think it goes beyond that. I think it's more of a thing. I don't want to get sidetracked on that right now. Is that what you want to talk about?
Yeah.
Okay.
You pointed out, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, about the necklace, how...
That's the next step. That's the next thing we're going to talk about right now. Okay? So now, he, in that same Pasuk, we're in Pasuk 42, Membeis. So then, he dressed him in linen garments. So what's the significance of linen garments? Why linen? Well, that's true. If you hold the place and look all the way back in Parshas Bereshis, before, this is way back. This goes back
4 years ago.
When the Torah, after it discusses the 6 days of creation, then the Torah goes back and describes what the world was like before Adam was formed. And so it says on page 12, it says in Pasuk Yud, verse 10, it says, V'nahar yotze me'eden lahashkos es hagan, and a river came out of Eden in order to water the Garden of Eden. U'misham yipared, and from there it split up, the river split, V'ayala arba'a rashim, and became four heads. So the river that came out of Eden to water Gan Eden then split into four parts. And then the Torah lists the four. Shemo Echad Pishon. The first one was Pishon. Pishon, Rashi tells us, is the Nile River. Hunilus, Rashi says. Pishon is the Nile River. Nahar Mitzrayim, the river of Egypt. Why is it called Pishon? So the one explanation is because the way Egypt was sustained is because the river would overflow its banks and water the surrounding area. And the word Pishon could mean to overflow. But there's another explanation, Rashi says. Pishon is because it grows pishtun. It grows linen.
Flax.
That's right. And the word Pishon has a relationship to the word Pishtim, which means linen. That's Rashi's second explanation for why the word Pishon is used to mean the Nile. So the Nile apparently had, maybe it still does, had a lively flax industry along its banks. And therefore, because the Nile produced the flax, and the Nile certainly was considered a deity in Egypt, even back at this point in time, because the Nile was where they got all the sustenance from. So, therefore, linen became a very special garment and was only worn by the priestly or royal class. So that's why Yosef being dressed in linen was a very special thing. And he put a revid hazahav, the golden necklace, on his neck. Now, I don't know why it's with the definite article the.
Where are you now?
I'm back on page 228, at the end of Pasuk Mem Beis, the end of 42.
Okay.
Where he dressed him in linen, and then he put the golden necklace around his neck.
A in the English.
Okay, that would not be an accurate translation, because it says Hazahav, the golden necklace. So I'm not sure why the definite article is used. But that would need some research. I think that's important. But as I pointed out before, it is interesting to note that this is the only necklace mentioned in the Chumash. If I'm not mistaken, this is the only time the word necklace is mentioned in Chumash, and it is used with a man. Striking, earrings, nose rings, bracelets, ankle bracelets. You find all kinds of jewelry associated with women, which is what we would associate jewelry with. But the necklace here is associated with a man, and it's associated with a royal appointment. It was some kind of a symbol of being of having some kind of a royal position. And so that's the necklace over here. So that's an interesting thing to be aware of, what the use of the necklace was. Yeah.
Wasn't the necklace mentioned in relationship to Moab? Wasn't the necklace mentioned?
Was it a necklace there? I think it was a bracelet. What does it say over there?
Signet ring, and a staff.
Yeah.
It was just the ring.
And when Eliezer gives Rivka gifts, he gives her bracelets
and
a nose ring.
But Tamar,
just the ring, the cloak, and the staff.
No, no, it's something else.
Okay, see if you can find it. But I don't believe a necklace is used. That's an important thing, that we find that it's a necklace is associated here with a man. Now, we know that there are prohibitions against a man wearing women's clothing, women wearing man's clothing. That comes later in the Chumash. We have those prohibitions. It's important to know that those prohibitions are time relevant, which means it depends what's considered men's clothing or women's clothing in the particular time and culture and country that you live in. And so wearing a kilt in Scotland is not women's clothing. Even though in the United States it would certainly looks like a woman's garment, but in Scotland it isn't. So it's acceptable for a man to wear that. Even according to the Torah, it would be acceptable for a man to wear that in Scotland because that's the way they dress. Assuming they still do today, but I'm assuming they do. But okay. So then you get into questions. What about earrings for men? Right. So that's a good question. That's a good point. And things can change. Now you realize that in the interim period, as things are changing, there's a problem, which is who's doing the changing, right? So as a person, you know, wants to adopt a new fashion. So now a woman's going to wear a man's garment. A man's going to wear a woman's garment, and so it's going to change. But for that time where it's changing, whoever's doing the changing, if it's a Jew who's bound by the Torah, they're doing the wrong thing by making the change. But once it becomes widespread that it is worn by both genders, then it is no longer a problem. The only time it still is a problem, and this is a subtlety, and I'm not saying this applies to earrings for men, because earrings for men today have become very widespread, so I'm not sure where this fits in. But there is a subtlety here, and that's as follows. If a man wears a woman's garment because he wants to wear a woman's garment, then it's still prohibited. You follow what I'm saying? In other words, if it's something that becomes that both genders wear it, so it's neither one. It doesn't identify a person as being male or female. It doesn't identify a person as being nobody looks at it as, oh, this is a male garment, this is a female garment. Then it's not a problem. But if it is something which is clearly a female or a male garment, and the reason why the opposite gender is wearing it is because they want to wear something which is a female garment, or she wants to wear something which is a male garment, then it's still a problem. That does not change the fact that it is a female or a male garment. The other thing you should be aware of is that this applies to things other than clothing. It does apply to things other than clothing. In a society where women do not bear arms, do not carry guns or swords, then those would be considered a man's garment, even though it's not a garment. But that would apply in those types of societies as well. Here in the United States, that's not true. Here, it's dual gender, but there are countries where that is the case, and it would apply there as well. So that's just a sidebar on how that works. But here it's interesting that in the Chumash, the necklace is a man's garment. Then he rides him in his chariot number 2, and they call in front of him Avreich. That's what it says in 43. They call before him Avreich. Avreich is a contraction of Av Rach. Av means father. Rach means young, soft, young. He is a father, but he is soft. He is young, which means this is a person who is the advisor to the king, which is like an Av, like a father, but he's young in years. He's only 30 years old.
This is in Egyptian,
I think,
that, or
in Hebrew? No, in Hebrew. Yeah. Avreich. I don't know what they actually said in Egyptian.
Rach means king.
Right. Rach can also mean king. Rach can also mean king. Rach can mean king. It can also mean, it can mean soft or young, because he was young. And it is from here, this is one of the places, and I've mentioned this before, that we see that Yosef was a bridge between the patriarchs and the tribes. Well, we know Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they're designated as our forefathers, their patriarchs. And then you have all the tribes. Yosef kind of is a bridge. On the one hand, he's a child of Yaakov, so he's a tribe. On the other hand, his children become tribes, Menashe and Ephraim. Yosef sustains all of his brothers, which is the job of a parent, to sustain the children. So Yosef kind of bridges that gap. He's been in between. He's Av, but he's Rach. He's a father, but he's also young. It goes, he's supposed to bridge that gap. He's put in charge of all of Egypt. Now, Paro says to Yosef, you're in charge of weapons, you're in charge of horses, etc. Paro calls Yosef's name Tzafnas Paneach. He interprets that which is hidden, which makes a lot of sense, that we understand. And he gives him Asnas, the daughter of Potipharah, Kohen On, as a wife, and places him over the land of Egypt. And Yosef is 30 years old when he became viceroy. Who is Asnas?
Asdina.
Okay. So,
she come from Dina.
Okay. There is a Medrash that says, well, the question is this. How could Yosef marry Asnas?
His half-sister.
No, before we get to that question. How could Yosef marry Asnas? It's not his sister, it's his niece. But how could he marry Asnas,
right,
if Asnas is the daughter of Potipharah? Who's Potipharah, anyway?
The one who put him in jail.
Okay.
About to be his mother-in-law.
Potiphar was the one who bought him. Right. He was a slave to Potiphar. Now Potiphar is called Potipharah, with an extra iron. Why is he called Potipharah? So the Gemara tells us that Potiphar, when he bought Yosef, he bought him because he was attracted to Yosef. Yosef was such an attractive person. Potiphar bought Yosef for illicit purposes, himself being attracted to Yosef. And he would have abused Yosef. The Gemara tells us that when he tried to, a malach, an angel came, Gavriel came, and was Misares Potiphar, which means that he castrated Potiphar, so that Potiphar should not be able to abuse Yosef. The word para is a word for castration. So here he is referred to as Potiphara rather than Potiphar to allude to this point.
It's feminine.
No, it's with an ayin. That would be the hey. It's with an ayin. The word para, perish ayin, is a word. There are a couple of words in the Torah that mean that, and this is one of those words. So that's why the term Potiphera is used over here, so we should know this point. That's what the Gemara in Masachas Sota tells us. You have a question?
Yeah, how did that happen? Did he get sick?
I don't know. I don't know how it happened. I don't know if it was if he, you know, just an accident happened, or if he got sick. I don't know. But that's the Gemara that tells us that. Now, the Medrash tells us that who is Asnas? Asnas is the daughter of Dina. That when Dina was abused by Shechem, when she was abducted by Shechem, that she did become pregnant. And she had a daughter named Asnas. The Medrash tells us that Asnas could not stay in Yaakov's house. She couldn't stay there because of the whole way that she was conceived and what happened. But they didn't want to just forget who she was. So Asnas was given a kemea. She was given a parchment to wear in a pouch around her neck. And I'm not sure, I don't know who raised her or how she moved around, but eventually she ended up in Egypt, and she ended up being adopted by Potiphar's wife. And she was raised by Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife, who also had designs on Yosef, she saw in the stars, the astrologers told her, that she would be connected to Yosef. She thought it meant that she would be connected to Yosef, but it didn't mean that. It meant that her adopted daughter would eventually marry Yosef. And so here Asnas is raised by Potiphar's wife. She has this kemea around her neck. I don't know why. No one ever investigated it. Perhaps it was in a language that no one understood, because it may have been. It was probably in Lashon HaKodesh. It was probably in Hebrew, and no one knew the language. And she had it. The Gemara tells us that Yosef as we see from all these stories, and that's why this is alluded to here about Potiphar, Yosef was a very attractive person. This we know from the stories before about Potiphar's wife. Yosef was a person that everybody wanted to look at. And if you had a chance to look at him, you would. And especially the women wanted to look at Yosef. The Gemara tells us that when Yosef became so powerful, he became the viceroy of Egypt, and now he was in his entourage going through Egypt, the women would line the streets to see. I mean, anybody would want to see the viceroy, but certainly the women did. And the women would throw something to him. They would throw something to him, hoping that he would notice them. So a woman would throw a ring, a woman would throw flowers. You know, everybody would try to get his attention, because here you have the viceroy of Egypt, and he's single. Right? He's eligible. So everybody was interested. So they're all throwing things as he's going by. Now this is Yosef who withstood Potiphar's wife. So Yosef is not going to be tempted. Yosef is, he's already risen above that. Yosef has become Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef, the righteous one, who can't be tempted. But when Asnas saw Yosef go by, she threw him this
amulet.
Now, I don't know how she knew to throw this to him. Nobody knew who Yosef was. Nobody knew that he was Jewish, that he came from Yaakov's house.
No.
But somehow, they knew he was a foreigner. They didn't know he was from Yaakov's house.
Oh.
And so for some reason or other,
this person
from the other side of the river.
But he always talks about his God.
That's true. But nobody associated him with Yaakov. They weren't aware of that. And so Asna somehow, maybe it's an intuition of some sort, but she throws this
amulet.
She didn't have anything else to throw. And she throws it, and he gets it. And now he's curious, because this wasn't gold, and it wasn't flowers, and it's just this pouch. He opens it up, and he reads who this woman is. And then Paro offers her hand to him in marriage. And that's God's intervention there, making sure that Yosef knows that she's an acceptable wife for him. She's actually his niece, which is an appropriate marriage. It is not incest for an uncle to marry a niece. In Jewish law, that's 100% acceptable. And now Yosef is able to marry Asnas, and Asnas finds her way back in to Yaakov's family. That's what the Medrash says over here. And so he marries Asnas. Why did Paro, I know we're a little bit over time, why did Paro want Asnas to marry Yosef? Because Paro had a problem. Because Paro had just taken a slave and made him viceroy. Now, what's going to happen when Potiphar announces, one second, that's my slave. Paro can't make him viceroy. So in order to placate Potiphar, he takes Potiphar's adopted daughter and makes her the Miss Viceroy, Mrs. Viceroy, the second lady. And as a result, politics. So now, exactly. So now it's very unlikely that Potiphar is going to protest, because now he has an in. This is his son-in-law who's now the viceroy. So that was Paro's reason. But obviously Hashem wanted Asnas to be back with Yosef, and also wanted Yosef to know who Asnas was. In the end, Asnas is a pivotal figure, because as we will see, Menashe and Ephraim, who are raised and become tribes, they're the only tribes who are raised in a foreign country. The other tribes are all raised in Israel. The other tribes are all raised directly under Yaakov's watchful eyes. But Menashe and Ephraim are raised in a foreign country with a foreign culture, with paganism all around them.
A foreign mother, because she was raised in that.
But she is the one who keeps them the way they should be. And they emerge as great people because of their mother, of course. So Asnas becomes a very, very pivotal figure, even though, as usual with the women, it's all very quiet. We don't get a lot of press about it. But Asnas is a very pivotal figure, and we will talk about her a little bit more, hopefully, when we talk about Menashe and Ephraim. Please remember that we are up to verse Mem Zion 47.